Welcome back to another episode of Awareness to Action Enneagram Podcast. My name is Creek, and I'm with my darling co-hosts, Mario Sikora and Maria Sevinita. How are we doing?
Well, we're obviously at the end of the adjective bucket here with darling.
Maria Jose, how was your trip for those that were clued in that you were away?
It was really good. I was away, but working with a team, and it went well. I had fun. So, sorry I missed
the episode.
I was going to say I missed the show, but it's a bit of an overstatement.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. No, yes. Mario, well, for those that are interested, Mario, what are we doing in a few days?
Well, in a few days, we're going to be together live in Nashville. We're doing a Train the Trainer program for people who've been through our certification program. And we're doing a weekend workshop on the instinctual biases and subtypes. So still time.
Well,
I don't know when this episode will go out. It'll probably be too late
there,
by the time
we're
doing
it.
Come out on Thursday, so they could.
It'll come out on Thursday, right. So it's Saturday and Sunday. What's that, the 27th, 28th, whether you're in the Nashville area or can get to Nashville by planes, trains, or automobiles, join us. And,
or horse.
Horse, whatever.
bike.
You know, you can bike. You can register at subtypesworkshop.com. www.subtypeworkshop.com.
There it is.
Yeah,
awesome.
It's gonna be great. I just saw a clip this morning on YouTube or something where on the Today Show in 1994, they had encountered their first email address, and they were debating what the at sign meant, whether it meant at or about and they were saying, yeah, it's one of those internet things. And, you know, the other person says, the internet, is that really a big deal? You know, it was really quite funny to watch. So, yeah.
And 94 is when you found out about the Enneagram, correct?
It is. Wow. Boy, it was a pivotal year.
Pivotal.
In history, right? The Today Show figured out what the at sign was about, what the internet was, and I was introduced to the Enneagram.
Yeah. And the founder of the new movement was born. Call back to last week's episode.
I am the beginning of a new tradition. Yes. That's a chapter in the Oscar Achazo, interviews with Oscar Achazo. Yes. He refers to himself as the beginning of a new tradition.
So. Which reminds me, we do a lot of callbacks.
Yes. And so listen from the beginning, folks. Yeah. If you really want to appreciate
if you see, if you think that we're being mean to each other, one, that's a form of love. Also, it's also just callbacks to other things.
There you go. Yeah. So we're going to do something different today, okay? And because we
are... You're a Greek expert. He wanted a bit more exposure.
Creek said, I want more airtime. You know, no, that's not true. And he's not going to get it anyway. But
Right.
You know, so, come on. Who are we kidding here?
It's just another way.
No.
Mario, I heard you're a great listener, though. Is that?
Well, that's, you know, I fooled at least some people into thinking that. Yeah. So, yeah, it's only circumstantial. Anyway, we wanted to do a kind of a special episode here and kind of do a bit of a check-in, right? I was surprised to see that last week was our 85th episode.
Wow.
Which, that's a lot. And, I don't know what we were thinking when we started this. The idea was just to kind of share the awareness to action approach with people. But it seems like we don't really run out of things to talk about.
And it might be
because it... What's that, Creek?
I just noticed the title of today's episode that you put in our recording session is TBD.
To be determined.
So that is... apparently, that's what this episode's about.
Well, the reason we don't run out of things is because every time we start a series on something, I interrupt it and go down to some rabbit hole like we're doing
today. I have an idea.
Yeah, I have an idea, right? I'm bored with that already, so let's move on.
We will return to vices and virtues.
We will.
Yes.
Yes, we will. Yeah. And so anyway, what we wanted to do today was look at the awareness to action Enneagram through the eyes of Seth Creekmore.
Who's that?
As it's the third Seth, I think. But but you know, we wanted to check in on, as Creek has worked with us over the past few years, what sort of impact for him this, you know, kind of different approach to the Enneagram has had, what his thoughts, observations, and lingering questions are. So
how much time are we doing today?
So my goodness.
So Creek, tell us, in what ways are we awesome?
No, but the really important thing is, who do you really like better?
Like I said in the text, that it depends on what I need, you know?
There you go.
Okay, yeah. Say more.
I suck up to who.
If you need comfort and support, you go to mom, and you know, and if you need to know how to change a spark plug, you come to me.
There it is. So, well, you know, it just, you both have a very direct approach, with which I really appreciate, but... yeah, it's if I need to talk through something a little bit more slowly, then it's probably Maria Jose. If I just want a quick answer, then I'll go to Mario. Yeah. So there we go.
Good.
It's out in the open. I just checked, Mario. I was looking at like how long I've actually interacted with you, and it was January 2021 was when we had that first Fathoms interview. And then Maria Jose, was it on the certification? Was that when we first met? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And that was, I don't even remember when that was, but.
And I think on that first Fathoms podcast, you thought I was a bit of an asshole. I think that I, you know,
did I?
You didn't quite come out and say it, but I could hear a little like.
No. Yeah.
Okay. No, we're talking about Creek. Great.
Anyways.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, what do you want to know?
Yeah, go ahead, Maria Jose. What's your first question, or your second question for Creek?
Can you remember one thing that make you kind of click in terms of, okay, I've been looking at all these approaches and there's something valuable here that makes me want to know more, and like there's this thing that could be different from the other approaches?
I think for me, it was the type as a verb. I mean, when Mario came on Fathoms and just it started to open up that when you frame things as verbs, then they're allowed to expand and contract based on what's actually happening, instead of having to square peg round hole things and do a lot of mental gymnastics to make things work. And I think that was when the awareness action started to make a little bit more sense as far as the approach, because as soon as you step out of noun and like these concretized states that often get expressed in the Enneagram and into more verb language, that's when I started to understand kind of the underneath of the ATA approach.
Have you applied that in your work, or how have you applied that? You know, I know you do some coaching with people, and so it's not just all your own inner work that you're focusing on, but how has that changed the way you interact with people that you work with?
I think in general, how I approach a lot of different things has changed because it becomes a lot easier to say yes and to everything, not just in my coaching and my personal work, like growth. It's like all of this is trying to do something, and all I need to do is be like, yeah, that's a thing I need to do, but we're going to do it over here. Or instead of trying to convince someone to adopt a mindset, it's seeing their mindset and redirecting their mindset. And I think that's just made it so much more. I don't feel like I have to have all the right answers all the time. I can just trust that if it's the person in front of me that I'm working with, it's like, trust that they're going to find their way through this problem. I just have to keep like doing little minor adjustments on either side to get them to where they want to be. I don't have to know their future.
you know, there's a lot of Cartesian dualism in the Enneagram world, right? Where
big word. Okay.
Is there now? Or is that just in your head?
So the reference here, children, is to Rene Descartes, I think, therefore I am.
Are you talking to us or to the listeners?
No, I'm condescending to anybody who's listening, so yeah. Not just the two of you.
Okay, good.
Right. It's, you know, this mind-body dualism, okay, that my actions are separate from, quote-unquote, who I am, right? And there's, you know, there's a great line when it comes to screenwriting that that character is action, right? Who we are is what we do. And now it applies to movie characters. How do you know who a movie character is? Or, you know, it's by what they do on screen. Right. And it's not just their behaviors, but it's their facial expressions. It's the thoughts they express, the thoughts they experience, the emotions and so forth. So it really is all about doing. And when you start keying into this idea of the verbs, the actions, and again, whether those actions be affective or cognitive or physical, that's how we really get to know people. Right, that's who we see how people really are. And when we fool ourselves into thinking, I'm not what I do, that we become trapped, right? Because how do you change who you quote unquote are other than by learning to think in different ways, right? Learning to manage our emotions differently, learning to act in different ways. But there's no other way to change. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's another thing with adopting more of a verb mindset is, and I use this example a lot of when I say I'm a musician, it's a shortcut. It's a package. A noun is a package of verbs, basically. Mm-hmm. And I am a musician because of all the small little decisions that I made over time to perfect a skill and to be able to express myself through that skill.
Right.
And it just, it helps shake the rigidness of an identity, I think, mm-hmm. because if it's just a collection of things that I do or don't do, then it's equally as easy to change that identity.
Right.
And
right.
It's not, I remember when I took some time off from music, being a musician was my only identity. And when I kind of let that dream die, I went down to Nashville to visit Seth Abram. I realized like, oh, I don't feel like I'm supposed to prove anything because I'm not a musician. Everyone else here is a musician. And to kind of be able to re-enter that identity as I'm a musician because this is just the things that I do. I don't have to prove it. I don't have to somehow become it. It's just... I don't know. There's something freeing about that kind of porous attitude to identity.
Yeah. It speaks to the challenge of labels, right? Mm-hmm. You know, when you call someone a musician, what are you really saying? And I like your term, would you say a packet of verbs?
A noun is a packet of verbs.
Yeah. You know, so a musician is what we call somebody who plays music, thinks about music, expresses music, records music, you know, whatever it is. It's not somebody who just, you know, if I was to call myself a musician, right?
Wow. You know a lot about music.
I know a lot about music, but I'm not a musician, right? I don't play an instrument. I don't know music theory. I don't read notes. I don't make music, right? But I'm still me.
You're a patron of the arts.
I'm a patron of the arts. I got a Spotify account and for my whole family. So it's an expensive one.
Wow.
Yeah. So there you go.
Yeah. And you got Miles Davis and Coltrane on either side.
I do. Yeah. Miles and Coltrane on one.
Showing off. So,
yeah.
So, Craig, what would be one idea that you resisted the most at the beginning, or that you wrestled with the most, that you had a hard time adopting of this approach?
I mean, other than changing from self-preservation to navigating, I think the terminology, the change of the terminology was not a big deal for me. I think pattern of expression was the hardest one. On some level, just because I had to trust observation. But then I think I realized that, like, oh, all of the Enneagram is just trusting other people's observations. Yeah. And I'm just trusting a smaller group of people that have observed this pattern of expression. There's
we
more than
lucky
just the
that
two
we
of
can
you.
Be called group.
And I also, once I was like, you know, let's just, like you said, Maria Jose, in a few episodes ago, let's just pretend this is true and see what happens. I can always go back. There's no risk in me just assuming this is true and seeing what happens. And I think what I really appreciated it about it was it decomplexified it to a point where there's only three, and it gave me a relationship to all three of those. There wasn't a blind spot. There wasn't always having to find the shame in one of them. It was just like, here's the relationship with these, and you get to be your own human in relationship with these. So it's going to look different. It's going to feel different. And no one can really tell you what is the accurate way of experiencing those. So, and again, I think the terminology is general enough to categorize, but not specific enough that ostracize your own personal experience.
Looks like you're running out of things to suffer about.
Yeah.
Well, can I add to that before you respond, Creek? Add to her question, I guess, or observation. Because we know I have to, Maria, right? I mean, a lot of approaches to the Enneagram really focus on negative stuff and, you know, oh, you're this way because of this wound, or, you know, mommy did this to you or daddy did that to you. Whereas we don't take that approach. It's just, hey, life's a bunch of stuff that happens, right? See what's happening and then deal with it. Going from that, you know, oh, life is suffering and we've got to wallow through all this, you know, dark stuff to figure out who we are, toward an approach that's just see what's going on and then deal with it in some way. Tell me about that for you.
Okay.
We didn't see that coming.
So when I was 5 years old.
No. Look, you know I don't care about that stuff, right?
Okay.
You know, yeah. Yeah. So,
not
but,
you
but
don't
I'm
care.
Curious as a practice.
Yeah.
But what I think is that people wallow in it unnecessarily, right?
Yeah. Okay. I think a lot of my life, based on my upbringing and just my proclivity to wallow as a four, I think I just got tired of the same old story and didn't feel like I was making any progress, because there's always something wrong. There's always something not ideal. And because of how I grew up, it was more like, oh, the way you improve yourself is by feeling worse about yourself. And that rang true to me, because at least from the four perspective, right? I thought the opposite was ignoring all that was wrong and all that was not ideal. And that is equally as harmful and toxic. So to have through ATA, but also through like a bunch of other work that I've done, especially in the Enneagram under other teachers, it's like, or things can just be as they are. And like one of the analogies that I use a lot is like, people argue whether the glass is half full or half empty. I'm like, you're missing the whole glass if you're seeing only half. So for me, the wallowing was an attempt to find meaning in suffering instead of the meaning just kind of meaning emerging from my wrestling with the suffering. I'm trying to make sure I'm answering your question. I'm getting a little off track here, but
You know that we don't hold people to answering questions. It's
yeah, and I think I mean I had a pretty stable childhood, pretty healthy upbringing, and so like I don't have a lot of big T trauma, and that's perhaps made it easier for me to kind of move on from that wallowing or from that fixation of trying to understand why this happened to me and how does this affect me. I think that makes it easier. But at the same time, I think the principle still holds true that it's like trauma is just rehearsing a past event. That doesn't mean that it's not still affecting you, but it is also, it's still limiting you if you're continuing to fixate on it to try to remedy the past instead of focus on remedying the present. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I would even say, you know, choosing the best course of action for, mm-hmm. you know, for today and tomorrow,
yeah.
is what we want to do.
And that doesn't always mean the doing, the action, the physical moving of the body, though it can be helpful. Right. I think the doing, to remind everyone, is still requires feeling your emotions and dealing with old stories and patterns in actual therapy. I see too many people using the Enneagram instead of going to therapy. But I feel like there's a lot of work that we can do without, is the word pathologize it? Without like making...
Pathologizing it.
Yeah. Without making a maladaptive action into some sort of trauma or diagnosable thing. Sometimes it's just a bad pattern. But it's not as sexy when it's just when you have to take responsibility for your own yikesness.
Well, you know, it's not as sexy, but it's also easier. Mm. Right? I mean, you know, it's easy to wallow, right? I mean, it's easy to come up with reasons. I was just having a conversation, for example, with a client, and the head of business development is struggling, and his approach is to say, well, you know, there's a lot of problems out there in the market and customers aren't buying like they used to and all this stuff. When the CEO's reaction to that is, I already know that. What are you going to do to make sales? Mm. Right. And, you know, and that's the question. It's easy to sit and say, wow, man, you know, people just aren't buying the same way that they used to, and they want something different, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, great. You know,
mm-hmm.
what are you going to do about
these
it?
These are true.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, yeah. So. Yeah.
One terminology that's been helpful. This is from the Buddhist teacher, Tara Brach. He's like, real, but not true. You're having real feelings about something, about your present situation, how it seems familiar from your past trauma or whatever, but that doesn't mean that it's accurate or true. Both of those things can exist at the same time.
So, Craig, have you experienced kind of the impact or the effects of tribalism where you... are kind of part of
it. Wow. Boy, you just jumped off that cliff. That's great, Rios. Hey, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. I want to hear where this is going. All right. Yeah.
And kind of Mario and I think are used to kind of being on a camp that does not agree with a lot of ideas from other teachers. And you move in circles that not necessarily agree with us. So, have you experienced any kind of tension or friction for adopting some of our ideas around people who don't?
Yeah. Do people dislike you for being our friend?
Not that I'm aware of. Not directly. No, I haven't experienced any of that. And part of that is, I think, it's just part of navigating. I withhold certain information sometimes
who I'm with. So people don't know what you really think.
Yeah. Well, it's not like anybody listens to the podcast or anything, you know. So.
Well, it's also It just makes for more interesting conversation because I have more places to sit. I sit on the other side of the boat, as I say to many of my friends. Like sometimes I'll get into a conversation and they're getting really frustrated that I'm disagreeing with them. And I'm like, okay, let me clarify something. I actually agree with you. I'm just being contrarian just to make the conversation interesting and to differentiate myself. So I think, yes, there is disagreement, but I feel like I've lived a lot of my life in several different worlds that if either side knew what I thought completely, neither one would like me. So I've found ways to code switch on some level to get yes and, but try to nuance and complexify the thing that we're talking about.
So you confuse people.
Yeah.
Use a bunch of adjectives that are relevant to their conversation.
Confuse people so they don't really know that you're disagreeing with them.
sometimes, yeah, when it's not worth it. But I think, I don't know, I just find it more interesting to find the things that, what's the thing underneath it all that we do agree on? And then just being intensely curious about the story that they're telling versus the story I'm telling, and just seeking to understand that point of view and how did they arrive there? And is there a door or a window I can open that'd be like, hey, you can have this thing that you love so dearly and there's more over here. So I don't know. Maybe it's just, maybe I haven't been out enough, but I haven't had any negative that to my face at least, but
yeah.
I think especially the younger Enneagram community is less interested in dogma. They can still be fundamentalist on certain levels. But I think it's just a generational thing where it's just, we've seen too many dogmas fail.
And
strong opinions doesn't equal dogma.
Strong opinions tightly held equals dogma.
Yes.
Strong opinions loosely held is a different thing. Mm-hmm. But I think you make a good point because the history of the Enneagram is one of contention, right? You know, going to, you know, Ichazo being pissed off at Naranjo, mm-hmm. being pissed off at this one and that one and so forth. And I think to your point, there's less of that in a younger generation. And, you know, there's a saying in science that science change when old scientists die, because they hold sway and, nobody wants to argue with them and, et cetera, et cetera. So there are these generational shifts. But it seems to me, no, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think the difference is also, if I am to encounter someone that is close-minded, honestly, that isn't interested in just a good old-fashioned tussle without being a jerk about it, like I'm not going to invest in them. I'm not going to try to involve myself in them. So when the people I do surround myself with are able to stay in the tussle and realize that we're all trying to figure it out. And yeah, if people can't do that, then I don't really have much energy or time for them.
And I'd be like, to dig in on this piece a little bit more. So, kind of being, spending more time with us and having more, I guess, access because of Fathoms and other things to, the older generations of Enneagram teachers like you do, like mm-hmm. people like Maria Jose. as well as being, strongly rooted in the newer generations, mm-hmm. The younger, the kids, as we say, kids. Say more, if you would, about what you see as the differences, right? So there's the idea of dogma is one thing, but and you didn't say this, but I'll say more of a sort of theoretical competitiveness that exists, among some of the older generation. But what are some of the other differences you're seeing?
Well, I think part of it is the schools have kind of coalesced. There isn't much of a delineation. Mm. It is way more normal to have a collective view. There's so many people that have gone to all the schools and gotten all the certifications. And so I think that's part of it. I think also with the, it's more natural to understand how science, philosophy, and psychology works. There's more ease of information, which is a good and bad thing, but you more quickly learn and unlearn things. And I, as well as just more interest in diversity, which brings more diverse levels of thought, and that requires different levels of listening that weren't necessary prior. The biggest thing is access to information. You can double check your answers quicker. You can unlearn and learn quicker. And you put your stuff out there, you're going to get critique a lot faster. For good or for bad, you know?
But that's certainly a huge difference. And I'll certainly agree with the for good or for bad, right? I mean, because there's so much stuff on the Enneagram out there now. I just had this experience yesterday that's getting more and more common when I'm working with people in an organization and I'm doing assessment interviews of them, and I ask them if they've ever heard about the Enneagram before. And, you know, 25 years ago, the answer was always no. And today, you know, it's, you know, I'd say 30-40% of people that I talk to have heard about it. But what they've heard is not always great. Because, you know, there's so much, like, you know, I had a guy the other day say to me, oh yeah, my wife and daughter talk about that all the time. And I hate it because they're always putting numbers on people and always saying, oh, you're such a this or you're such a that. And, you know, and so we had a conversation about, you know, the problem with that. And number one, they mistyped him too, right? So, which is, you know, they were calling him an eight as an insult when, you know, he was not an eight. But, you know, a lot of superficial stuff out there being passed on. And so that's problematic. But
and I imagine as you get further away from the original source, it gets held lighter and lighter because the opinions are not personal. Like, I didn't come up with this idea.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah.
So I just learned it from you all.
Yeah. Look, if you got a book, you know, you know, you write things in books, you know, I mean, you know, there'll be times when people, you know, quote something to me that I wrote, you know, years and years ago. And I say, well, I don't really see it that way anymore.
Right.
And, you know, and, or let alone I do a training based on a set of ideas. And then, geez, how am I going to make my living now? You know? So I'm curious again, Creek, as, you know, somebody who's, you know, substantially younger, than Maria Jose.
Wow.
I'm teasing. Of course, I am significantly
Imagine
older than Maria Jose.
Imagine how much younger he's than you.
Yeah, I know.
He's so much younger than I am.
I don't want to think. I don't want to think about that.
Well,
so
that's
why I'm. That's why I'm saying the other way. No. So as you know, someone who is younger, and you think, you know, more. There's more future ahead of you. What do you see as the future of the Enneagram?
Oof. I'll try not to be pessimistic. I guess I've seen this, I've seen this trend. I think the Enneagram is going to become less and less of a thing and more of the idea of being an Enneagram coach. I don't think it's going to be a thing. I think it'll be just another tool that coaches or therapists use, continuing to force it underground. And not be tied to specific language, but letting the model inform the language, the specific unique language that when I'm addressing a client or somebody, or it's more of a theory, a concept, a formula of how to process information instead of needing it to be a religious text or like something that needs to be,
or a complete body of knowledge in some way. Right. And, you know, and in fact, I, on my Substack recently, mariosecura.substack.com,
many plugs.
I wrote, you know, a little quick article on, you know, are you an Enneagram coach or a coach who uses the Enneagram? Because, you know, whenever I see somebody saying, oh, I'm an Enneagram coach, I immediately start to say, well, time out here. You know, that's, what does that mean? The Enneagram is not sufficient to be, to make somebody a coach, right?
And it's not an end in itself.
Exactly. It's a tool.
It's, right? And especially as I've like learned y'all's way of approaching the Enneagram, honestly, the smaller the world has become, not the world, and the world of the Enneagram has become smaller, and I've hit the edge really fast. And I forget who said it, but it's something along the lines of like a good theorist, like a good practitioner knows when their ideas stop, like where's the end of their idea. And if you don't have that accountability, you don't have that delineation, then you are prone to abusing it to, that's where guru-ness comes in. That's where a bunch of nasty things happen, is when
and
you can just start making things up.
Providing a worse service to your clients. I mean, if you think that with the Enneagram, you can do really good work all the time, it's just, it is so incomplete. You need many other tools.
Yeah.
And that's one of the dangers of the religionification of the Enneagram, right, that I'm seeing among people and, you know, pulling out that Gurdjieff, you know, or I guess it was Uspensky who, you know, or one of those guys quoting Gurdjieff that, you know, oh, if you understand the Enneagram, you understand everything, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, no, you don't. I mean, that's just stupid, right? And anybody who thinks that way is just turning into some sort of fundamentalists, right? That, you know, oh no, I only need this one book or I only need this one thing and then I understand
that's
everything.
It's just so boring.
Yeah.
Right. Like, forget that it's fundamentalist. It's just like, it gets boring after a while. Yeah. Like, you're just
very
rehearsing
quickly,
the same nine things. Ugh.
Yeah.
Anyways, good. We need to wrap it up.
All right, good. Okay, so hey, Creek, you know, this was fun to to get your perspective on things, just to kind of a check in.
To have slightly longer pauses between you talking and talking.
Well, that part I found difficult, and you know, and I found myself growing bored.
Yeah,
but you know, but which is what happens when other people are talking.
No, really,
it's look, we have you here because we value your input and your insights.
Thank you.
So it's nice to kind of hear from you a bit more on occasion.
Awesome. Wonderful.
All right.
All right, folks. We will see you next week, if not in Nashville. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Awareness to Action Enneagram podcast. If you're interested in more information or talking to Mario, MJ, or myself, feel free to reach out to us through the links in the show notes or by emailing info@awarenesstoaction.com. All episode transcriptions and further information can be found at awarenesstoaction.com/podcast.